This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Earthwise, Environment and Peace with Justice interviews on Plains FM 96.9. We'd like to thank PEDET, the Peace and Disarmament Education Trust, for their support.
Good evening, I'm Martin Griffiths. Lois is with me for this evening's program, which features an interview with Rob Ritchie. Rob is part of a committee that is interested in proposing establishing in New Zealand a Pari Haka Day on the 5th of November to be celebrated instead of Guy Fawkes Day. And that's what we'll be discussing. So welcome to Earthwise, Rob.
Welcome, thank you.
Well, why do you think New Zealand should have a Pari Haka Day?
It's timely. I think we're starting to realise that we're a nation of the Pacific rather than an extension of British colonialism. So I think it's really timely that we should now gently put aside Guy Fawkes and recognise something that's been kept from us, actually, quite deliberately kept from us, the story of Pari Haka, which is 5th of November, is a significant day in that story.
Don't children learn about this in school?
No, and not that I'm aware of. They may now. They may well learn of this in school now, but I didn't, and I went through an education system from my preschool years, and I learned nothing until I was at theological college when I was in my 30s.
So 30 years after your primary school.
Yeah. 30 years. I would have been mid-30s by the time I heard. So, yeah, 30 years of silence from the education system about this.
So let's talk about Pari Haka.
So this is the 5th of November 1881 rather than the 5th of November 1605, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Mm. It's approximately, 400?
Something like that.
300 years later, yeah.
Now, where is Pari Haka?
It's in Taranaki. It's directly west of the peak of Taranaki Maunga, or as it used to be temporarily known, Mount Egmont. And it's a village that has not been on the map for 100 or more years. And that's why I didn't see it in my geography atlas, because it's just not been there. It was deliberately excluded from any official maps and records.
Well, interestingly, about 10 years ago, Lois and I happened to be driving round the Taranaki region after a forest and bird meeting, and we were specifically looking out for this village, and we tried to find it on the map, and we drove all the way around the mountain, and we didn't see a signpost, so we missed it, and we didn't know where to go.
Yeah.
I thought there might be something like a historical marker or a little, some sort of museum or something.
It is a historical marker itself, but to get to that, it's not easy to find. And it's been, as I say, officially non-existent for quite a long time.
Now let's set the scene for the original incidents of Pari Haka, because they're quite interesting and really of international historic interest, I think, because it was a sort of a beginning of passive resistance, wasn't it?
It certainly was unprecedented in this part of the world. Except, I think, as far as I know, for the rules that governed life on the Chatham Islands and Moriori for 500 years had a ban on killing and a refusal to resolve conflicts by extreme violence.
Now, we had the sometimes called the Maori Wars, are they? They were land wars in the 1860s, was it?
Yeah, they seem to have got going in the 1860s near Pari Haka, around the other side of the mountain at Waitara. That's usually regarded as the point at which the wars began between the colonial and indigenous.
And it was a land grab, really.
Yeah, populations, yeah. And it was a land grab. And now we look back, we can't say and see it as anything else.
How many years did the land wars last?
Well, by the time the November the 5th event happened at Pari Haka, they'd been going for over 20 years.
Right.
But as the Waitangi Tribunal report says, for Taranaki Māori, the land wars were decades long, more than 20, more like 40, 50 years, because there'd been a very long and kind of deliberate plan to dispossess all Māori in that area, because the land is incredibly fertile, yes, and desired by colonial forces and colonial eyes had been on it for a very long time.
So even before the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840.
Yep, I think that's what the tribunal found. There were plans to evict Māori from that area for even before the treaty.
Yes. The impression I got was that the land wars were felt to be over, and this block of land around Perihaka was considered Māori land, and Te Whiti built on this, was able to gather some of the dispossessed people and became quite a leader.
Yes, I think that there are two significant individuals in this, and one is Tohu Kakahi and his cousin Te Whiti Rongomai. And they, I think, had observed firsthand the fighting in the 60s and 70s. And it's unlikely that they participated, but they certainly had seen how devastating it was. And I guess they concluded that it benefited Māori not a bit. So they were both acquainted with some of the sayings of Jesus through the Reimann-Schneider mission, which was a place that they had some of their education. And they decided that it would be timely to employ the idea of loving your enemy and turning the other cheek. But that didn't mean that they would walk away and leave their ancestral land. They stood very, very firmly on it, and that absolutely infuriated the forces that were trying to dispossess them.
I think that they were quite advanced in a lot of their agricultural ideas, and it was supposed to be quite a thriving community.
I think by the turn of the century, said to be the most developed and most sophisticated municipal community of the North Island, and certainly there were many, many Māori who streamed there, because I think after 20 years of fighting, the appeal of doing something which was non-violent resistance was very attractive, and it created a tremendous problem for an administration that was geared to war, because these people would not retaliate with any kind of physical violence.
And I think Te Whiti's idea was that this was Māori land and it could be governed and run in Māori ways, total autonomy, in other words.
And people were welcome there, and quite a number of Pākehā were well known and welcome there, because they accepted what I think is called mana whenua, that belonged to the village and the three houses of the village, because there are several iwi represented in that village. And they accepted that they came under the umbrella and the rule of that village and of those leaders when they were there. And the beginnings of a very good relationship between Pākehā and Māori in that village, and it remains. I mean, I am at times in contact with people there, and they are always bending over backwards to welcome anyone, not just the children of the colonial forces like myself, but anyone from around the world. There are people who go from all over the world to that place, because it's become a bit of a place of pilgrimage.
In fact, Gandhi must have heard about this when he sort of...
It's really hard to establish that.
I think Gandhi
that.
Was only 12.
At the time of the eviction, which is what actually we are remembering on the 5th of November, when the whole village was overrun by colonial troops. But I don't think it's clear whether Gandhi knew very much, but there is a story about a group of Irish politicians, I think, who were in South Africa at the time, and they met Gandhi, and they knew about it, and they told him. But that's not actually able to be confirmed yet. I think there's a PhD thesis for someone here.
Yes.
I think that Martin Luther King might have heard of it, though.
I think it's inevitable that King would have heard of it, because he was initiating nonviolent resistance some sort of half a decade later.
So let's just set the scene, what actually happened. There was supposedly peace between the Pākehā settlements and this separate Māori bloc. But I think the Governor-General went away to Fiji, and the native minister named Bryce decided that he was going to invade.
Yes, and also the man who had been our superintendent of Canterbury, William Ralston was there as well. He was basically wringing his hands in anguish about what was being done, but he didn't stop it, and he stood by as Bryce literally kind of arrived on a white charger with a saber in his belt and marched into this village and brought 1,500 troops with him and removed the two leaders. And there wasn't a single hand raised in resistance. It was an extraordinary encounter, which I think morally Bryce and his administration are condemned for forever.
Yes, I think when the colonial troops entered Parihaka, they were met by children.
Yes, there were.
It was.
I think it was completely
girls skipping.
Well, it was literally disarming for all the soldiers. Yeah. They just didn't know what to do. They were met by the troops on foot, and the cavalry were met by, as you say, children. They were offered food, watermelon, bread. I mean, there was this love your enemy thing that had gone so deeply into the culture of that community by then that they were just totally in a strange place, didn't know what to do.
Now, they were quite used to fighting wars. They just wouldn't understand this.
Yeah, yes. It was. Yeah. And there's been some wonderful poetry written about it. There's a poem by Chris Osman about it, because his grandfather or great-grandfather was there, and he writes this poem to try and kind of understand this 19-year-old kid who was his grandfather, looking over the parapet, pointing his gun into the middle of this group of people and what it must have been like for him. It's lovely. Chris Osman's poem. I can't remember what he calls it, but it's a great poem.
So they arrested Te Whiti and...
They did.
Tohu. Tohu,
sorry. Kakahi, yeah. And they were taken away. Six months in New Plymouth, about 16 or 18 months in South Island, being shown the marvels of Pākehā technology, which didn't really impress them very much at all.
But I heard a story that they took Te Whiti around Christchurch to show him the wonderful buildings,
yeah,
and how superior white man is.
Yeah.
And they asked him, well, what do you think? He said, you've got a really nice river.
Yeah, he was absolutely, and I think both of them were completely bowled over by the river, because rivers in Taranaki tumble down from the mountain. And there was this great thing
snaking through
Christchurch, and they were just enchanted by it, and they wanted to walk beside it around the gardens.
Uh-huh.
The South Seas and colonial British exhibition was on, and they just... Well, they walked around and they looked at it, but...
they were impressed by the river.
But they loved the river, yeah.
You're listening to Earthwise, broadcasting Christchurch on Plains FM 96.9, in Hamilton on Free FM, and in Waikanae on Coast Access FM. Today's guest is Rob Ritchie of Ōtautahi Parihaka Committee. We are discussing the idea of commemorating on the 5th of November, not Guy Fawkes Day, this isn't England, but instead Parihaka Day. Today's broadcast is actually a repeat of an interview we did with Rob 2 years ago.
Let's return to this evening's guest, Rob Ritchie.
Rob, I think we need to continue the story of Parihaka, because we've mentioned the troops entering the village,
yeah,
and arresting the two leaders.
Yeah, and one or two other people as well.
But then there was much more to it, wasn't there? It was
quite
a lot of destruction.
Oh, following the invasion of the village on that day, I think it's said that it took 2 months for the garrison troops there to destroy the gardens. They were very extensive gardens. There was raping, looting, all the usual things. Hideously usual things that happen
in war
and after an invasion by a dominating force. And that also involved a huge number of people being exiled or sent home. There was a relatively small number of people who were allowed to remain. And even by the time the eviction happened, there had been many, many people in prison because of the deliberate and very creative passive resistance strategy they'd used. And this, I think, is really important for people to know about it. It comes from some very deep traditional roots, including Christian roots, and that is that they followed the idea that you turn your swords into plowshares. So one of the things they did was that they plowed up the villagers would go out, men from the village would go out and plough up the land of the settlers who had been given or sold land by the government in the surrounding district. And that meant that many, many men, something like 400 plus men, were exiled to the South Island, to jails at places like Huketika, Ripapa Island and Littleton Harbour, the Littleton Jail, the Addington Jail and Dunedin. There's a Cilla McQueen poem which is really amazing called Fuse, F-U-S-E, Cilla McQueen, and she describes the job that the Parihaka men had to do in Dunedin to make the road out to Port, not Port Chalmers, Tyrawhead, Head, I think, on the south side of the harbour. But these some
forced labour, sort of.
Yeah, forced labour, yeah. Absolutely. And, yeah. And Ngāi Tahu have a very strong connection with Taranaki through that, because it was Ngāi Tahu who brought food and blankets to the prisoners, who assisted them as they made their way back home after their release. They were just released, and they had to find their way back. This is 1881. They had to find their way back from the deep south back to Taranaki. And so it was Ngāi Tahu who assisted these Taranaki people all the way back, and there is a memorial to them at Rapaki, at the village, and Marae near to Littleton, which is still a way of commemorating the connection between Ngāi Tahu and Taranaki. And there's also a stone, I think, at Anderson's Bay in Dunedin, which has been blessed and consecrated recently to remember the prisoners there, and probably one on the west coast around Huketika as well, I think. That's been done recently.
So these Maori, they weren't charged in a court. Were they? They're just detained.
Right, these are important things for people to understand. Yeah. No, it was basically, I think, for the only time ever, suspension of what they call habeas corpus.
Yes.
I mean, they were held completely illegally, and Tohu and Te Piti were held for 2 years.
Yes.
And they continually requested a trial, and they were never allowed to be heard in court.
I think Te Piti was accused of sedition at one point.
Oh, yes. They were accused of all sorts of calumny.
Of course, guilty in a court then.
But he was hated because he united Maori. I think the settlers used to rely on sort of friendly Maori to get their way.
And he was able to unite them all. Yeah, well, he had a very friendly approach. It was very, very welcoming. And if you go to the Peace Festival, you'll be struck by how welcome you feel, no matter who you are.
I've got a quote here from Te Whiti, actually. He said, "Though the lions rage, still I am for peace. Though I be killed, I yet shall live. Though dead, I shall live in peace, which will be the accomplishment of my aim. The future is mine, and little children, when asked hereafter as to the author of peace, so she Te Whiti, and I will bless them." It might mention a symbol of the Parihaku resistance is the white feather, isn't it?
Yes, that's the albatross feather.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. It's not the feather of submission that we associate with the white feather.
Yeah, maybe there's some wonderful humour in that, but it's known as Tiraukura, and it's some three feathers, white feathers that are worn by people who are descendants of that.
Tohu had a vision of an albatross descending towards the Marae and blessing them, and the feather coming off, and that's how it became their symbol.
There are a number of ways in which the feather seems to have appeared. There was a comet in the sky, and I think that was not long after the eviction in 1881, as far as I know, and it may well have been a well-known comet, but it had the shape of a white feather. So these are things that I don't know a lot about, but I know there's an enormous amount of spiritual and actual physical symbolism in this, of the feathers being worn and the feathers appearing in the sky.
I think perhaps we ought to. There's a connection, really, with what happened there and what happens today. Or there's a sort of a relationship, because the Taranaki report, which I'm looking at now, emphasizes that Parihaka is symbolic of autonomy, of the right of indigenous peoples to maintain their society on their own terms, and to develop, from mutual respect, a peaceful relationship and partnership with the government.
I think it's very timely. I think it's something that Māori have never stopped insisting, that the treaty declares that quite clearly. If you read the Māori version, that tino rangatiratanga is something which I understand to mean self-determination, sovereignty, that's always been assumed and emphasised. But I think also things like the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People, which has just gone through the United Nations and been been signed by, well, pretty much every country except New Zealand and one or two others, is just another kind of historical waking up that's happening around the world, that Indigenous people don't just have rights, but I think also people are starting to understand that Indigenous people have a way of living which may actually save the planet if we watch and listen and become acquainted with it.
But at least not be afraid for Indigenous people to do things on their own terms.
Oh, I think that that's a fear that's whipped up by some politicians well known to all of us. But it's a completely unfounded fear that's just basically trying to wrest control away again from communities that have nothing but goodwill to all people.
Perhaps we should just finish by saying we're not being anti-Guy Fawkes Day, which I just see as a time to set off fireworks. But the important thing is that it happens to be November 5, which should be an important day for New Zealanders to reflect on their own history.
Oh, at least as important as commemorating Gallipoli. And I think that there are some marvellous suggestions being made about where skyrockets and fireworks and public displays of that sort could happen. And I think the middle of winter is, well, for families, probably a bit more appropriate because the sun sets a little earlier. But also, there is the gradual realization that we do have a New Year celebration in middle of June called Matariki.
Yes.
And I think both Māori Women's Welfare League and also the Māori Party have endorsed the idea of, or maybe they suggested the idea of having fireworks at that time.
Yes.
So these are 2 days we could celebrate and better understand our own history.
I think it is really timely that we do put aside the sort of fireworks on 5th of November now, especially its association with state-sponsored violence. And let's have it as a celebration for another time of year. And I haven't heard any people yet, the ones I've talked to, maybe they're just all trying to be nice to me, saying it's a bad idea.
Well, thank you very much, Rob.
I'm afraid our time is up.
It is, yeah. Thanks very much, Larson Martin.
What we have just listened to, an interview with Rob Ritchie of the Ototahi Perihaka Committee, was a repeat of a program Earthwise broadcast in 2015. Well, it hasn't happened yet. New Zealand still commemorates Guy Fawkes Day instead of Perihaka Day. It's so important to know our own history and the early New Zealand example of nonviolent resistance to opposition. New Zealand could lead the way for the world to turn away from militarism before it's too late. And my sympathies are with the Peace Action members who wanted to shut down the Palmerston North Weapons Expo. So from us at Earthwise, goodbye.